Scopers Podcast, Episode 2, The Iron Giant, Hoghug. Welcome to the Rotoscopers Podcast, an animation podcast for animation addicts. Disney, DreamWorks, Pixar, Don Bluth, and everything in between. I am your host, Morgan Burt.
And I'm Chelsea Robson.
And I'm Mason Smith.
Okay, how's everyone doing today?
Fantastic.
Yeah, just great.
Oh, good. I'm doing great.
Mason, that doesn't really sound very convincing.
Convincing, yeah.
Oh, no, this is awesome. I mean, we've got this is our second episode, so we, like, survived the pilot episode, so I'm feeling good about this.
And this is also our second time recording the second episode.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, practice makes perfect.
Yeah, so for everyone, you know, we're new at this. We're working out the kinks. We were halfway into our last episode, and we recorded 45 minutes worth.
And then we thought,
and we realized we didn't push the record button. It was really sad.
Yes. But this means that you get more quality.
We're doing this for you.
Or it was a complete mistake. All right, well, let's dive into the animation news for this episode. Last week, we got our first three images of concept art for Disney's newest animated feature coming up. It's called Wreck-It Ralph. The synopsis is we've got this villain character, Wreck-It Ralph, who lives in his own video game, and he moves to other video games to prove that he's a good guy. You see from the concept art, there's a variety of these video game worlds that he goes to. One of them is this first-person shooter. It's kind of an action-looking image called Heroes Rush. And he's enlisted to fight as the website says, a marauding horde of cybugs. And you can see quite clearly that there are cybugs attacking in that image. And it looks pretty cool. I mean, it looks like a lot of first-person shooters, you know, these days. And I think that kids can relate to that. Then he enters a world called Sugar Rush. It's kind of your Candyland video game world. He sees that something is attacking Sugar Rush Land. And it originated from Heroes Rush, so the cybug world. So what's cool about this is that the audience is going to see a lot of different visual themes for each video game, and it adds variety, and I think that's going to be interesting as an animated feature.
Yeah, these first three concept arts we were able to get from Entertainment Weekly. I think they look really cool. I love the colors that they have. They look really vibrant, and it gives a good feel as far as what we would be expecting in this next film. But there was one thing that I noticed a little bit that kind of caught me off guard when I first saw it. I looked at it, I'm like, there's one picture of Wreck-It Ralph where I think he's probably sitting on a hill contemplating his being of, should I really be destroying things with my life? Is this really the best thing to be doing with my time? The first thing I saw with it, I'm like, he kind of just looks like Donkey Kong, which really does throw in the even more so of the memories of passing the weekend trying to beat any of these video games for me.
Yeah, I don't know about Wreck-It Ralph. I'm not quite sure. I mean, it's during the same era of Donkey Kong. I don't know if it was a copycat or lookalike. I looked at some videos of Wreck-It Ralph, the actual game, and it really is kind of like that Donkey Kong game where he's standing on the top and throwing things down, and they go down the ramp and they slide down and whatever. So it's kind of funny. I think it's just kind of interesting that they picked this movie to adapt. I mean, out of all the video game franchises, this is it's pretty obscure in my mind, and I'm pretty well-versed in video games, but I'm sure Nintendo wasn't, you know, so up for them doing Zelda or anything like that. So it'll be interesting to see where they take this and revamp this franchise.
Well, I'm sure the owner is very happy with this. Yahoo! All those years of waiting.
Yeah, definitely. And they finally make my movie!
I've been waiting for this for my whole life.
Take that, Halo! You'll never have what I have. I'm everywhere you're not.
That's exactly what he's thinking. Comes out on top.
Yeah, there you go. Awesome. Who would have thought? Yeah, so that's great. We're definitely looking forward to more concept art as that movie comes into development. All right, moving on to other news. We've got the Los Angeles Animation Festival coming up in March. It's from March 7th to the 11th. And our focus in this episode is actually The Iron Giant by Brad Bird. And The Iron Giant at that animation festival will get a revival screening. And so I think that's cool that fans of animation will be able to see this movie again in kind of a theater setting. And so it's pretty cool there. And I also think it's cool that we're reviewing and discussing The Iron Giant in this episode and that it's making the news now.
Yeah, I think I love The Iron Giant, and it's really cool that for an animation festival, obviously they know what they're talking about, and that shows a lot for The Iron Giant that it's getting this replay value. So if you're in LA and you get the chance, go to it and tell us how it is. I'm really jealous that I don't get to go.
I know, seriously.
Yeah, I'm really jealous. I kind of wish I wasn't in school right now so I could attend this, this animation festival. Also in their lineup, they're also screening Akira, which is a Japanese animation milestone, definitely. And Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants, will be hosting on opening night.
Yay!
Would not want to miss that. I wonder if he's going to do like a SpongeBob impression.
How can he not? He has to at an animation festival.
Something I'm not very stoked about is that they're showing Team America at this animation festival.
Yeah, maybe I take back what I said.
Hey, I mean, I guess I can see where they're it's puppeteering and, you know, that's an art form in itself. But I mean, Team America, why don't you just watch Thunderbirds? That's what Team America was based off of. Thunderbirds was the inspiration, you know, in the parody that they made. So folks, you know, I really hope you don't just stick with Team America. Go on Netflix, watch instantly. The movie Thunderbirds Argo is on Watch Instantly. So go check it out. Go see the real thing.
For sure.
So the next bit of news. Last week, we talked about Illumination Entertainment's movie, The Lorax, which is based on the Dr. Seuss book of the same name. And this week in the news, they're making waves with their marketing campaign. So what they're choosing to do for their marketing, it's definitely going in a very unique direction, a.k.a. it's green. So I know Chelsea's going to really love this one.
See, now you guys think, you're still thinking that I'm not like, I don't like the environment. I do. I do like the environment. I mean, for goodness sake, I was an intern for a nonprofit organization called Rescue a Million, which helps save kids and the environment. I went to China to do a tree plantation, for goodness sake.
I went to China. So,
you guys
so
don't
wait a minute.
Let me get over this.
All right.
I like trees.
I don't know. If you see this movie, then that means you like trees.
Yeah, I bet.
So how exactly is The Lorax going green in its marketing campaign?
Okay, so what they're going to be doing is they are partnering with about 70 organizations like the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and Whole Foods Market. And what they're going to be doing is they're going to be doing very eco-friendly campaigns for these different things. And so I'm a marketer in my day job. That's what I do. So whenever things like this come along, it really catches my attention to see how they're being unique, how they're being clever, what they're doing. So the fact that they're not just going to McDonald's and they're having toys with all the 7 characters or whatnot, you know, that's just pretty standard. But they're really extending the message of the movie beyond the movie and practicing what they're preaching. I think that's pretty admirable. And it's actually exciting. I mean, what they're going to be doing is, you know, instead of the Happy Meal toys, they're going to be doing things like planting trees, conserving energy, partnering with all these eco-friendly companies. One slogan is they're encouraging people to live like the Lorax.
Live like the Lorax. Does he wear clothes?
Uh-oh.
That's kind of a deal breaker for me. Okay. When I first saw this, I was thinking, you know, the first thing I thought was, are they going to make a Happy Meal toy lineup for the Lorax? And I guess not. I did a Google search, and all the main articles are saying that they are not doing a Happy Meal toy lineup. So this is unique, you know. Whole Foods Market, you know, I don't see a lot of kids, like, really buying into that. But like you said, you know, they're practicing what they're preaching, and the Lorax is, you know, it's all about, you know, the environment and trees. And we all know that Chelsea loves trees.
I do.
From reading these articles, I've read that we can expect to see stickers on eco-friendly products that say Lorax approved. And so we can know how to live like the Lorax because you are consuming products that are Lorax approved. I mean, that's cool for me. I mean, as long as I don't see like a Lorax disapproved sticker on my double stuffed Oreos, you know, just leave them alone, you know. But yeah, they really want to
lay off me. I'm starving.
Seriously, Lorax. And right. So they really want to get their message across. Now, to me, that seems a little bit in your face. What do y'all think?
I agree. It is very much coming out at you right in your face. They're not leaving anything to the imagination as far as their desires of what they would want us to do. But, you know, that also makes me feel like I'm not doing enough. You know, even though I did all these cool things, I still am not feeling this good thing. I feel like I have to go out and, you know, get new light bulbs and maybe even change my shower head, but I'll get there.
No, I think it's exciting. I think it's new and fresh. It's a topic that's always kind of mentioned. This book is super famous. It's one of the most famous anti-industrial children's books out there. But I don't know. I don't really have any problem with it. I mean, it's making the Earth better in a way, slowly and surely. And so.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, we'll see. I mean, it's a pretty interesting marketing campaign, like you said. I don't know. I'm kind of interested to see just how the movie goes.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it really worth all the hype?
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
So moving on to this next item of news, we just had the 10th Annual Visual Effects Awards, and I want to talk about one movie in particular. Nickelodeon and Paramount's Rango won 4 trophies at the Annual Visual Effects Awards this year. It won trophies for Outstanding Visual Effects, Outstanding Animated Character, Outstanding Created Environment, and Outstanding Virtual Cinematography in an Animated Feature Motion Picture. Really long title on that last one. Yeah.
Put that on the trophy?
Yeah, I guess they printed it all on the trophy. Big trophy.
That's a long thing.
Or they make an acronym, the OVCAFMPT.
Ooh. Right? That is
catchy.
So if our listeners remember from the pilot episode, we talked about Rango as part of our news about our favorite films of 2011. I liked it specifically because of the environment that was creative and all the visual effects. It was really well done. And here we go. Rango just won 4 trophies in it.
Yeah, it also won the BAFTA this past week for Best Animated Film. So that's actually a good sign for hopefully the Oscars to see if they will also reciprocate that award.
Yeah, absolutely. Other honorable mentions at the Annual Visual Effects Awards were Transformers 3, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and Hugo. Hugo, from what I've heard, is kind of a milestone in its 3D effects. Planet of the Apes, of course, had Andy Serkis doing really good motion capture, as he always does. Transformers 3 broke the record for the number of hours it took to render a single digital frame in an animated sequence. So Industrial Light and Magic, it was doing a sequence where this kind of drilling snake-like transformer takes out a skyscraper. And I saw the movie, and it was an incredible scene. Took 288 hours to render a single digital frame, pixel by pixel, during that sequence. Yeah, you do the math, folks. That's over 10 days. And of course, Industrial Light and Magic used up its entire render farm to do that sequence. And that particular Transformers model was made of 70,000 individual pieces.
That's so expensive.
Yeah, that is insane. I could leave it to Michael Bay to go big like that.
Oh, man. And I just think of even if you're looking at like your power bill, that's a long time to have all those things going. But you say it was worth it?
You know, with the Transformers movies, if they cut out all the humans talking and just had one, like, 5-hour-long movie of all the Transformers movies where the parts where the robots are beating each other up, I'd be satisfied. Otherwise, I just can't get into Transformers, like, as a movie as a whole. But the visual effects are stunning, and they're amazing.
So our next news story, Miley Cyrus has dropped out of the film Hotel Transylvania.
No.
And Selena Gomez has taken her place.
That is so significant.
Yes.
It really is.
Yeah, anyways, next. Just kidding. No, really the only thing that I think is interesting about this is that this movie's supposed to be released in September or August, and already it's February. And typically for an animated film, you record the voices first and you animate to that voice. So it's kind of late in the game to be changing your main actor, but maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe it's just really simple dialogue. Who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about this movie. I might go see it just because it has Adam Sandler in it, but I don't know about these, like, star-studded casts, you know, in an animated film.
Well, you know, sometimes it works out, and sometimes it's just to cover up for a mediocre story. Well, we'll see.
Yeah.
All right, so let's move into something a little more substantial.
Oh, come on.
I know it's Selena Gomez is really close to our heart, but we're just going to keep going. Disney has just put out a new short called Paper Man, and it is said that it's going to revolutionize the animation industry.
It is them fighting words.
That's what I'm saying. Sources have told that this uses an approach to 3D animation that is truly a game changer. And when you see this, anyone who uses mocap or motion capture will look ridiculous.
Wow.
That is a direct quote. So what do you guys think about this?
Well, here's the curious thing about this whole thing. Usually it's relatively, you know, it's not that hard to get like a leak for a new project that Disney is doing. You know, information leaks out pretty easily. This has been pretty well kept under wraps. The way they found out about this short called Paper Man is they found it on an MPAA ratings list. You know, down at the bottom, they found a short film called Paper Man by Disney that's rated G. So it already has a rating. You know, it's just a bunch of rumors. Nobody's really quite sure what it is. Here's a little clue about what it might be. Eric Daniels, a Disney animator, has been linked to this Paper Man article. And it says Paper Man uses a technique that he helped create. Now, Eric Daniels, he previously worked on the film Tarzan. He created a process called Deep Canvas. You can see the Deep Canvas demo online on YouTube, specifically for the movie Tarzan. It allows animators to paint an environment over a CG model so that the computer is able to keep track and precisely recreate the animator's application of the environment as the camera moves around in the 3D space. Like I said, you can see a Tarzan video of that on YouTube. From what I can tell, it looks like some sort of conversion technique, maybe that blends 2D and 3D, kind of, you know, hinting towards what Eric Daniels did in Tarzan. This is just total speculation here, but it could be something like a technique that converts a 2D image to a 3D CGI model. And that's just the Book of Mason. That's, you know, that's just a rumor. That's just speculation. But to me, it looks like it's definitely going to be something like that. And like we were saying, it's going to make motion capture look ridiculous, and boy, you can just leave it up to Disney to revolutionize the world of animation. They've been doing it since the beginning of Disney animation, and they're still doing it, and I'm really excited about this.
Yeah, I think this is a really good sign for the future of Disney animation, because I think for a while, I mean, their studio was shut down completely after Home on the Range.
Why do you end on Home on the Range?
I don't know whose idea that was.
That was just so sad.
You know, that'd probably be for another episode, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I just think it's interesting that they're you know, really pushing the boundaries and pushing the technology and becoming a leader again in this space, because I think there's been a lot of players that have taken over, especially when it comes to 3D animation. Mm-hmm. And I like that this ties back to their roots, which is traditionally animated films. They're trying to, like you said, Mason, bridge the gap between those two art forms that are both beautiful and spectacular. It'd be really exciting to see this Deep Canvas or this Paperman expanded a little bit more. So I'm excited for it.
Yeah, for sure. I was looking at some of that YouTube video that you were talking about where Daniels goes through and is explaining all of these different things. It just blew my mind. I still can't believe the type of a mind that would be able to come up with this stuff. These are such smart people. And it's such a talent that I wish I had, or at bare minimum understood. This is one of the reasons why we have come to our in-house animation specialist, Mason Smith.
Mason!
What up?
So we've come to him and asked him if he could give us some background on a lot of these basic principles and elements of animation. So, what is it that you have to teach us today, Mason?
Well, our focus today is on Brad Bird's The Iron Giant. It's a great film, and I didn't want to pass up the opportunity to talk about the element of story within an animated feature. I wanted to talk about this particular element because I actually attended a seminar in November where we had two directors from Sony Animation come in and talk about story in an animated feature.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, and the two directors were Fergal Reilly and Doug Sweetland. Fergal Reilly was a storyboard artist for The Iron Giant. He also did storyboard work for Space Jam. He did Open Season. He also did storyboards for The Smurfs, which was released last year. Doug Sweetland, for anyone who knows, you know, a little bit about the Pixar story, will recognize this name. Doug Sweetland was an animator for the majority of the Pixar films, starting with Toy Story and going on to do... he was actually a lead animator for a couple of Pixar films, and so he's a pretty big deal in the animation industry. Right now, Sweetland is hired on with Sony Animation. He's now directing The Familiars. It's a film that's going to come out in 2014, animated. It's based on a book series. I'm not really familiar with The Familiars. but yeah, so that's where they're at right now. And so I attended the seminar. They had a lot of great points to talk about the story, and I was just so excited about this episode because Virgil Riley worked on The Iron Giant, and that movie has such a killer story. Riley started off by saying, "Everybody, this is a direct quote, everybody has a story. If I pointed to someone here, they would have a story, and I bet it would be great." And I just love that quote so much. Like, I fell in love with it. Lots of positivity. I think that's relevant in today's animation world. You have to be positive in order to have, you know, a great film. Yeah. You know, look at Pixar, you know. The movies have their low points, but they're just a bunch of feel-good movies. It's reflected in their story.
Yeah, what I like about that quote that you just said, that everyone has a story, and I bet it would be great. You know, I think maybe my story, oh, it's not that exciting, or, you know, this other person or this person. But it's really, if that is true, everyone's story is great. It's a matter of how you tell it and how you present it, which makes it great and exciting.
It's always the spin.
So, yeah, and, like, a great animated feature comes from a great story. And, you know, any story can be turned great. So any story can turn into a great animated feature.
Yeah, and we're going to see that as we discuss Brad Bird's work on The Iron Giant, definitely.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
Keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros, two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude, stop with the voice. Keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
Now, going down deep into the components of Western story, Riley and Sweetland, they gave their takes on the formula for a Western story. You know, that's your basically your three-act structure that has a setting, it has a conflict, and what the protagonist does to resolve that conflict. Riley and Sweetland, they differed a little bit on story, but it's basically the same. But there are also some pretty funny differences, especially coming from Sweetland, who is a Disney Pixar animator. And Riley, he had the three-act structure. Going through the first act, this protagonist, he says, has this desire. And he goes through, he does an action to help him achieve that desire. And so what does the character want? What is he wanting to achieve? And what does he do to achieve it? Going into the second act, we find a conflict that goes against the main character's desires. And there, Riley says there's a lot of possibility for entertainment, entertaining moments, entertaining situations. As the conflict progresses and intensifies, you go into Act 3, in which the character learns a lesson, he changes, and it helps him triumph over this conflict. And, of course, there's the resolution, and there's how the story's universe changes after that conflict. Sweetland was basically the same. He had the same three-act structure, but his sounded a lot like, I don't know, it sounded like every Disney film I've ever watched, which was pretty funny. yeah, he started out with, okay, you start with your protagonist. He makes a choice, and he has his action, and it works for a while. Act 2, which he says is usually the longest, pose you got your conflict and then an even bigger problem that arises, and it clashes with the protagonist, and it brings this protagonist into a low point. And I was thinking in my head, boy, yeah, that kind of makes sense coming, you know, from a guy, you know, working at Disney Pixar. And yes, all the Disney movies and Pixar movies, there's always a super low point that the protagonist finds himself in.
Yeah, this sounds like The Incredibles.
Yeah, look at Mom.
Like the low point for Mr. Incredible when he's standing there, he's being held up by Syndrome, his head hanging, he's found out his family's died.
Now, okay, you just said that. That's awesome. Riley, right when Sweetland said that, Riley was like, yeah, strip everything from the character. Rip the characters apart. It's fundamental to story.
It's fundamental.
And
isn't that cool?
Yeah. Well, they did that.
Yeah. So Sweetland goes on, and he goes on to say that the protagonist then makes the biggest, hardest choice that he's had to, that he or she has had to make, and it ties into the theme or the lesson, Disney, of the film. And, you know, the light goes on in their head is what Riley said while Sweetland was explaining. And then you have your resolution of the conflict. So I was like, wow, that is so Disney. That is so Pixar.
Yeah.
And I loved it. I loved that little part.
They've got the recipe and they just keep
on brewing.
Keep on up.
Yeah. And speaking of that recipe, the bottom line that Doug Sweetland wanted to make was that simple stories aren't bad stories. You know, every great story starts out basic, and the themes, the twists, the funny characters, the irony, etc., it's all part of discovering that story. But you start with a very basic formula. Iron Giant, you've got a boy who finds, you know, this amazing robot that he has to keep secret because the world wouldn't understand it. Or, you know, you have, you know, all the movies where you have your misfit character and he's kind of rejected by society and he has to choose between being himself and being what the world wants him to be, you know? Mm-hmm. Simple stories, but, you know, we get so many variations in today's film world, not just in animation, but, you know, everywhere. But we see it a lot in animation. And Riley wrapped it all up by saying it's all about character. You think of these characters, and as you discover them through the storytelling process, your themes and your elements of storytelling, they emerge, and it adds complexity to the story. And so that definitely changed my views on story in an animated film. I'm really glad I went to that seminar. And I kind of didn't know who Doug Sweetland was until I looked him up on Google, and I was like, holy crap.
What the?
You're awesome. Like,
Doug Sweetland. They were just swell guys. Like I said, super positive. They asked us questions. They were really friendly. And it just made me so excited to be an animation student. And it was so, so interesting to talk about story with them. So with that in mind, let's talk about Brad Bird's The Iron Giant. To me, it's proof that animation is a form of storytelling, and we're going to get into that more in a little bit. It's proof that animation can be just as effective as telling a story as live action.
If not better for some movies or some stories.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. So our main discussion today is Brad Bird's The Iron Giant.
Yay!
Hey.
Let's all clap.
Welcome to downtown Coolsville. Population? Us.
So many good quotes in this movie.
There really are.
We'll talk about them. And, you know, essentially the premise of this movie, or what Brad Bird presented to the Warner Brothers studio at the time, was, what if a gun had a soul? So really, at the bottom, now you strip everything out, that's what The Iron Giant is about. So some general info about it. It was released August 6th, 1999. So I remember being in Hawaii when this came out and seeing, like, previews. I didn't see it in the theater. But...
You know, I never saw it in theaters. For some reason, we didn't go and see it.
Well, there's a reason. While it's a unanimously critically acclaimed movie, like, on Rotten Tomatoes, it has a 97% certified fresh approval rating, which is unheard of. Well, not unheard of, but...
It's very,
la creme
very good.
De la creme.
I mean, it's Rotten Tomatoes, for crying out loud.
Yeah,
they'll rip you apart.
They have a lot of rot in there. But, okay, so despite all of that, it didn't do too well in the box office. It only made about $23 million domestically and was considered a huge box office failure. And really the reason why I didn't see it, the reason why you didn't see it, you know, our families didn't take us.
Reason why I didn't see it until this week.
Reason Chelsea didn't see it. Here's my marketing background, but everyone blames the ineffective marketing campaign. So pretty much what happened in this period of time is that, you know, Warner Brothers, they just come off Quest of Camelot, which was a huge flop. You know, they tried to copy the Disney formula and routine, and it didn't work for them. It just failed miserably.
Yeah.
Would you say an epic fail?
Epic failure, yeah.
They had one good song in that movie. That was it.
Our in-house song girl.
Hey, it's what I'm here for.
So what happens is that, you know, unlike Lorax, you know, this movie needed a Burger King promotion, and they had that all set up, but the executives at the time said, no, we're not doing it, we don't have enough time, so they cut everything about it. They just, you know, completely lost faith in the family feature animation. And as a result, no one knew about it, people didn't, you know, get a chance, and afterwards people were asking these WB executives, like, why didn't you push this movie? It is amazing. And one of them even said, this is the quote, he says, people always say to me, well, why don't you make smarter family movies? Lesson is, every time you do, you get slaughtered. So he said this after the fact the movie had came out, you know, trying to prove his point. Like, well, look what happens. Like, we got slaughtered. We made an awesome movie. And I think that's just kind of a cop-out answer. I mean, it would have done fabulously if they would have gone about it the right way.
For sure. Any great story like this really would have done well if you really do have to
push it in the right direction, get the right people in charge, the right machine running it.
Yeah, it's a shame it didn't do so well in the box office because it's such a great movie.
So going back to who this was directed by Brad Bird. Brad Bird also did Pixar's The Incredibles, Ratatouille, and also what I know him from is he was involved from the beginning with The Simpsons. You know, he was a creative consultant on The Simpsons. He even directed a few episodes, which are phenomenal episodes.
Classic.
And so I kind of knew him from that, and that's where he got his start, I guess. He graduated from CalArts with John Lasseter and kind of like the main, you know, group that kind of revolutionized animation in the 90s. And he went on to The Simpsons, and then this was his first feature-length film that he directed. They got the script. They thought it'd be fabulous for him. And he is my all-time favorite director, you know, whether it's animation or not. Like, when I found out Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol was coming out, like, I'd never even seen the other Mission Impossible movies. Never seen them, you know, but I wanted to see this fourth one because it had Brad Bird's name on it. And I knew that anything he touched turned to gold. And it's true. I mean, I think all of his movies have 93% or higher on Rotten Tomatoes, which is also kind of unheard of for directors because they always kind of...
Yeah, holy cow.
Yeah, isn't that incredible? So,
yeah, that's crazy cool.
Yeah, he has one that's 93, and I think all the rest are 96 or above. Straight A student right there.
You bet your money on him.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things I really love about him, I've watched a lot of commentaries with him and read a lot of interviews. Every time he talks, he's always saying how he's a stalwart that animation is not a genre. He says genre is horror, it's romance, it's comedy, but animation can be any of those things. So he gets really offended and defensive when people say, oh, animation is just a genre. It's not. It's a universal way to tell a story. According to him, he says animation is storytelling. Storytelling can be anything. And that really goes back with what Mason was saying about story. Brad Bird is really founded in the principles of good storytelling, you know, whether that be an animation or not. So that's another reason why I think this movie's as good as it is.
Yeah, Brad Bird is just so sharp. He's a sharp guy. He's not just nerdy about this. He's passionate about what he does. He's in it for the storytelling of animation. He's in it for the magic of what the animated feature is and not for the money. And that's a mark of real quality filmmaking.
Some of the key voices on this one was, you know, you had Jennifer Aniston, who played the mom. Harry Connick Jr. played the beatnik Dean, who, you know, he's a beatnik. Did you not notice this?
I had to look up what a beatnik was on Wikipedia.
What is Chelsea, explain a beatnik to Mason.
A beatnik is, you know, in the 50s, it was right before the hippie movement came in. And so they're very much into arts. They're very much into snapping their fingers and saying, yeah, this is cool, dude, man. You know, a lot of times they're like the beginnings of the goths, because a lot of times, most of the time, they're in all black. They just have a very...
The beret.
Yeah, they have a very stereotypical way. Or at least every time that they're depicted, it's in a very stereotypical...
Soul patch.
Yes. Exactly.
All right, so I just got a question. On the extremely goofy movie, that poet chick in that movie,
yeah,
would she
exactly.
be described as beatnik?
This is beatnik.
She's a beatnik, but in the wrong decade.
Right. They, you know, but Goofy Movie is famous for throwing in lots of random things, so we accept it. So these were really cool. Really cool. I loved seeing Harry Connick Jr. as this because he does so well. But then we also have Christopher McDonald. He was also the antagonist in Happy Gilmore, which I loved him in that movie. He did a really great job. So he plays a really good antagonist again here in Brad Bird's The Iron Giant.
Yeah. Actually, okay, trivia time. Does anyone know who did the voice of the giant?
Ron Perlman.
Wrong.
No?
Oh, come on, man. This is good times.
Anyone?
Jason Statham.
Come on.
All right, I've known this one for years. Was it Vin Diesel?
Oh, ding, 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 ding.
I would have said something, but I have the answer right in front of me. That is cheating.
You know, ironically, this is one of Vin Diesel's more, like, emotional roles. Like, you know, you don't see him as kind of, you know, he doesn't do a lot of heartwarming roles in his career.
He really doesn't. What was cool is Brad Bird, he actually had a lot of freedom with this script because of some of the failures that had happened, like what we were talking about.
Yeah, what happened, you know, Quest for Camelot, it completely bombed in the box office. So all the executives, they weren't into animation. They moved on to other things. It was already kind of in the works. And so they just kind of threw their hands back and said, you deal with it, you do your thing, which inevitably set them up for failure. They weren't going to support them when they needed it for the marketing. But what was really cool is that this film was made entirely by the animation team, which is unheard of in Hollywood today. You know, there weren't the suits there. There weren't lots of departments and committees, which often get, you know, they dabble in projects. So,
yeah, and I think that was a big concern that Brad Bird has had, from what I understand, from what I've read from his quotes and stuff, that, you know, he doesn't like the duplicity of the animation industry. You have to deal with the committees and the departments and the suits.
Yeah, so he was allowed the freedom that he wanted and made the movie that he wanted to do. And as a result, it's just an incredible movie. It makes me wonder, what are the movies we could get if some of these committees and departments took a step back and let the creators really make the movie they want to make? But I don't know.
Seriously.
If we'll find out. Okay, so let's move on talking about the actual movie itself. Essentially, it's a boy in the Cold War meets a metal giant.
How would you react?
Hilarity ensues.
Hilarity ensues.
Hilarity ensues. Brad Bird, talking about the Iron Giant, he said, we don't have the obnoxious celebrity sidekick. We don't have the goofy sidekick. We don't have Fife tunes, you know, musical songs, and we don't have this goofy foppish villain. And
wait, you really don't need I would like to say that you foppish? Really don't need the foppish villain. You just put a patronizing cynic who works for the government. You know, that's all they did.
Is a foppish villain.
I guess.
Once again, I had to look up foppish on Wikipedia.
And?
It says that there hasn't been a page created for foppish. So.
Oh, well, maybe we should do that tonight.
Epic fail.
So how do you like that Kent Mansley guy? I mean, he's talking to Hogarth. He's so lame.
Yeah, like I loved during there's a montage of him trying to get answers from Hogarth. And he's like, hey, champ, hey, slugger, cowboy, chief, buckaroo. I mean, just like those really patronizing names that you would say to a child. Like, and then, you know, he walks in and he gives him his hat. He's like, here, pretend you're a gangster.
Oh,
come
God. Kent Mansley, folks, Kent Mansley.
That is the best. But I have to say, that is probably one of the best ways to make any kid hate this guy. You just throw this guy in there who just says, you know what, I don't really care about anything, and I'm just going to talk to you like you're two. You don't matter. Every kid is just going to look at like, I do not like this guy. Get rid of him now.
Yeah, and not only that, he's trying to blatantly take away his new toy.
Exactly.
So. There you go. Yeah, you know what? I like this movie because the setting is—it's not this magical make-believe kingdom that we see in other studios. It's just contemporary history, you know, on Earth. And so, you know, the beginning of the film, it goes through town. It's Earthlings at a town, you know, going about their daily business, and we can relate to them. You know, it brings it down to our level, and it emphasized the coolness of the Iron Giant's character. You know, he's this extraterrestrial, and he's totally out of place amongst the humans.
Yeah. Personally, the giant reminds me of Jason Bourne from The Bourne Identity. You know, he's a super massive killing machine. He wakes up one day and he doesn't know who he is. So he goes on this quest and he discovers his past and what he did. And then he starts to question that. He says, is this really who I want to be? You know, I know The Bourne Identity came out a little later, but that's what I was thinking this time around. I'm like, predecessor. The Iron Giant did it first.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting point. And the concept of losing one's memory, you know, you see it all the time in film. To me, it helps when the character discovers the truth. He gets his memory back and he discovers, you know, what he is supposed to be and what he wants to be. You get to see the character make an important choice. And the giant is such an amazing character. And when we see him make that important choice, you know, going back to the story elements, it draws the audience in. It makes for, like we've been saying, a terrific story.
Yeah. Does someone want to give a brief synopsis of what happens?
Sure. Well, what happens, this was actually the very first time that I was able to see this movie. It starts out as this robot kind of shows up in the middle of the ocean, and everyone thinks that it's an extraterrestrial. Everyone thinks that he's going to kill everybody. And so everyone becomes a little bit afraid of this. A little boy, he finds this robot and ends up saving it. And the robot makes a conscious or unconscious decision to be this boy's friend. And they become friends. They try and help each other. And along the way, this boy makes other friends and then also has the antagonist come in, which is the guy who works for the government, Kent.
Yeah.
And the government is now trying to find this machine that's probably going to kill them because it's during the age of Sputnik. And so they're all very paranoid about everything. And then the very end, it comes down to a showdown to see whether or not they can actually get rid of this quote-unquote problem that they have. But so basically that's the synopsis of, you know, I'm not going to give away the ending, but that's the major points of the story. But what are some of your guys' favorite scenes?
This isn't really a scene. Well, I guess the beginning and the end of the movie, they begin with beeps. So there's beep, 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 you know, and it's kind of a nice way to bookend the story because at the beginning the beep is Sputnik, which is the Russian satellite, which is going around the globe. In essence, a metaphor for all the paranoia that was going on during that time. And at the end, you know, the beeps continue. Sputnik has kind of died away in their minds, and the beep is of the giant. And I just kind of thought that was a cool way to represent the shift from paranoia to acceptance of this thing.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so, that's something I didn't notice that. So thank you.
Yeah, I like it. So one of my favorite scenes, well, I love almost all the dialogue that Hogarth, the little boy, says. But I freaking love that scene where he goes to Dean's and he's like, what do you got to drink? He's like, well, there's coffee and like milk. And he like drinks the coffee. And then everything that Hogarth says right afterwards, he just goes on this like caffeinated rant about his school. Oh, my God. It's so funny. And
I thoroughly enjoyed that myself.
Yeah, this is espresso, you know. It's like CoffeeZilla. I said I'm hip.
Yeah, actually, this is the only scene that Brad Bird, the director, animated himself. So I thought,
holy cow.
Yeah, it was kind of cool. He had to animate all the in-between scenes. Like, normally you animate the keyframes and your in-betweener does it. But because Hogarth was hopped up on coffee, he was talking so fast, he had to do the in-betweens. And it was actually kind of a lot of work, but it's probably one of the most memorable scenes of the movie.
For sure.
I'm hip.
Yeah, I'm hip. Oh, I love that kid. So this is just the guy in me, but I really love it when the giant, he turns around, he sees the army attacking him, and then his eyes turn red, and he goes into, like, super extraterrestrial gun mode, starts blowing away the military. Oh, man, I loved it. Like, one arm turns into a gun, the other arm turns into a gun, and then his whole body turns into a gun. He just starts
like
blowing
a giant laser. Not even a laser. It's like a bomb.
Yeah, I'm not really surprised why you liked Transformers 3.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised.
Well, hey, like I said, I love the parts of robots beating the crap out of each other. So sue me.
What guy doesn't?
Yeah, well.
I love the scene where the hand is parading around the house. He's trying to get back to the giant, you know, because he's disconnected. And during that part, Hogarth gives this completely blasphemous prayer. And the mom's face, she's just sitting there with her hands underneath her chin.
She's like, just staring at him. What have I done?
Like, I'm not going to interrupt this. I'm going to let him pray. And then after, she's like, that was very interesting, Hogarth. You know, like, I'm not going to reprimand. He's doing a good job. What is going on?
Yeah. No, and then, like, he's trying to chase around this, like, giant hand that's walking around his house. And then Hogarth comes in and he's trying to, like, distract the mom. And so he, like, throws a penny at the little spice rack. And then it, like, falls a little bit and then crashes to the floor. But she just looks at us so nonchalantly and just, I guess I'll go clean that up. And apparently this happens a lot.
Yeah, Hogarth must be throwing a lot of pennies to distract her. Because she's like, oh, that darn spice rack. Let's go clean it up.
But then you also have, like, the death of the deer, which was, like, all my Bambi nightmares coming back at me. I was like, oh, sad.
You had Bambi nightmares?
I did. It was a sad thing.
I kind of accepted Bambi for what it was from very early age, but...
Well, I guess I'm just a little more sensitive.
Okay. I don't know, man. Like, I'm from South Texas, so when, you know, whitetail season rolls around, I mean, it's just a fact of life.
Well, it's a good scene for both Hogarth and the giant, because they're both coming to grips with death. The Iron Giant, he doesn't really know what's going on or what it is, so he's learning about it for the first time. And Hogarth, he is living it. His dad, which we come to find out through little bits and pieces that are said or shown, that his dad has died, you know, so he's still coming to grips with death, and it's a pretty, like, a tender moment for both of them as they're kind of learning together the mysteries of the universe.
Oh, yeah. Here's another great one. The standoff between Kent and Hogarth, you know, when Hogarth goes to bed and Kent just, like, sits down there and he, like, just stares at him. You know, he's got this stakeout going on. And I think it's so funny. You saw it a lot in the 90s, maybe because I was a kid during the 90s. But the whole kid versus adult theme is, it's fun. Like, it's cool. It's kind of, I mean, you saw that a lot, like, you know, watching cartoons for, like, Nickelodeon or Disney. And so I just thought it was fun. I thought it was a really cool scene.
Once again, this goes into the Beatnik philosophy of taking down the man.
That's great.
That's good.
And like Morgan was saying, you know, we get a little clue into what happened to his father. You see a picture of his father. And I think I remember the father's, like, in a flight uniform.
Yeah.
Okay, so, like, it gives you a little
bit
more.
He was in World War II and something happened, you know, because now it's the 50s.
That's true.
But, yeah, yeah. I love that they, you know, I was watching some of the deleted scenes. And in one deleted scene, the mom and Hogarth, it's their introductory scene. They're talking, they're driving somewhere, and it's just very obvious. Let's talk about the dad. You know, we're going to talk about this and really put it in the forefront. But I like what they did by cutting that scene and changing the way that the characters were introduced, that we learn about it just through cues. Like, I love when a movie doesn't have to tell you straight out what's happening. When you can pick up on it by just a look or a picture, it gives a lot of credit to the audience. Like, we're smart, okay? You know?
Yeah.
And even little kids will pick up on that. Like, oh, there's a picture of him and his dad.
And everything that implies.
Yes.
So, talking about powerful scenes, for me, the most powerful scene is the one that makes me emotional every time is when the giant decides to go and intercept the atomic bomb that's being pointed on Rockville the town. Mm-hmm. He goes off to sacrifice himself. Hogarth comes after him, and the giant points him and goes, "You stay, I go." And then he points back to Hogarth. He's like, "No following." Oh my gosh! So going back to that seminar I was at, Fergal Riley, who, you know, storyboard artist for this film, he told us that while the story people during the production of Iron Giant, while they were going over the storyboards for that scene where the giant goes to sacrifice himself, and he tells Hogarth he can't follow him, people were, like, crying. Like, it brought people to tears, like, in those meetings, like, just going over the storyboards.
Really?
And yeah, and it certainly made me tear up, like, watching it. And it's just a really touching moment. And, you know, there we have it, folks. We got more, you know, evidence that this is storytelling. Like, this is, you know, real quality storytelling in an animated film.
Okay, so let's talk about the animation in this. Since we are the Rotoscopers podcast, we talk about animation.
Oh, yeah.
I love that voice every time you do it.
Oh, yeah. Let's go.
Okay, random trivia. This has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but I just remembered it. Okay, so you know that one part where after the train wreck, Kent comes and he's interviewing these two guys?
Yeah, I do remember.
Okay, the two guys, they're voiced by Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnston, who two animators from the Nine Old Men.
Yes, those, like, the Disney famous guys that they did everything with.
Yeah. Holy crap. Yeah, they were the ones who wrote The Illusion of Life. It's like the book on Disney animation.
Yeah, on any
animation.
Oh
my gosh, that's cool.
Yeah, so, and actually, these two men were a huge influence on Brad Bird's career. You know, so obviously it was a tribute to put them in there, but apparently he couldn't get enough because he put them again in The Incredibles. They're at the very end of The Incredibles, and there's like, well, now that's old school.
That old school, like the old school. Oh, so, sweet, I just made that connection.
Yes. Nice. Isn't that awesome?
That makes so
much
sense.
Dude, that is so cool.
So, Brad Bird, I love cameos in the first place, but especially awesome cameos like that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you can't get more awesome than Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnston.
So this movie was shot entirely in CinemaScope, and that was definitely an artistic choice by Bird. So CinemaScope, essentially what it is super widescreen. It's really what they were using in the 50s. So he wanted to recreate that era.
So it's kind of like what Sleeping Beauty, yeah.
Where it's just like the length of it just goes on forever,
uh-huh.
And then the height is a lot shorter. So the aspect ratio is 1 to 2.35. So... for all the people, the nerds out there who want to know that.
Hey, we want to know.
They probably already do know, but hey, just in case. So I think that was really interesting because it kind of is another way to envelop you in that world of the 50s. You know, there's the paranoia of everything. And not only that, he's recreating the feeling of those 50s films mm-hmm. with the aspect ratio, just kind of the subtleties here that he's doing.
Yeah, as well, totally. As, like, the colors, too.
Oh, yeah. What I noticed watching it recently, I actually watched it today just to kind of stay fresh with it. You know, the first scene where Hogarth and his mom are at the diner and Hogarth's trying to get his pet squirrel back. Everyone's kind of, they're kind of saturated in their colors a little differently. Hogarth and his mom are brighter, and so we notice them better. You know, they're kind of the focal point of that scene. I think it helps us kind of filter what the focus is on, because there's a ton of people in that diner. It's busy. Yeah. People are ordering. And yet we know the scene is about Hogarth, his mom, and Dean. And so Hogarth and his mom, like I said, are depicted as more vibrant in their colors than the other folks at the diner. Going back to Hogarth as a character, if you notice, in every scene he wears either something red or blue or yellow or a combination of all three. You know, for anyone who's taken an art class or gotten to color theory, those are the simplest primary colors.
They're also the most eye-catching.
There you go. And so those simple eye-catching colors, it helps, you know, establish kind of like a childlike character. We saw that you can do that. That's one option. They did that with Mushu in Mulan. Mushu is entirely colored red, blue, and yellow, colored in the simple primary colors. And ironically enough, Superman has that same color scheme. And, you know, we all know that Superman was a big part, mm-hmm. big element in this film. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, the giant, you know, he eventually becomes Superman, or that's who he's trying mm-hmm. to emulate. But the giant, he was actually entirely computer animated. And I didn't know this.
I didn't know that either.
I couldn't tell. No, yeah, I think they did such a really good job blending the CGI. Because I think of some movies where it's a 2D traditionally animated movie, and they throw in some 3D characters. And, I mean, the human eye is very perceptive, and we can sense a foreign object,
yeah.
you know, right away. And one that always pops out to me are all the vehicles in Anastasia are 3D, and they yes. just seem like, why is that there? And it just doesn't flow the way that a pencil would flow onto the paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so what Brad Bird did, he decided to use computer animation for the giant to make it really rigid. To sense that this is a moving metal object. You couldn't really get that with hand-drawn. But then at the same time, they wanted to blend it in very well, so they textured it, and they created this special CGI program that kind of waved the lines of the giant just slightly. You know, just as if you were an animator, you're not going to draw perfectly perfect every single time. So this, the lines on the giant would kind of curve and wave to make it feel a bit more organic.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting. For something that's metal, you need to try and make it organic for animation. I think it works perfectly. If you don't even know this is CGI, you wouldn't even pay attention.
Oh, yeah.
So to me, that's good animation. Brad Bird and his team of animators, they utilize this technique to make the movie special, to really render out this giant as this mechanical, technological character. And it makes the movie special. It makes it more fluid, and it makes it more believable as an audience. Like you said, Morgan, like we can pick up on stuff. And it's pretty seamless how they integrate the 3D CGI model of the giant with everything else. It reminds me of Walt Disney's quote at the end of Meet the Robinsons, where he's talking about keep moving forward and going back. It's just great animation that they're utilizing techniques to kind of be progressive with animation. And to me, this is, you know, a milestone as far as that goes.
One other thing is the art design was actually very much based on the art of like Norman Rockwell and Edward Harper and the N.C. Wythe. It's very 50s, and it just comes across so well. I love seeing those different, the different lines, the different face structures, the different color schemes. It's a very familiar feeling that makes you feel safe through the whole thing.
Yeah, mid-century art definitely mm-hmm. has that feeling of kind of like everything after the war. It was safe, it was happy, reestablished.
Yeah.
I think of the one part in the movie where Hogarth is watching this horror movie on TV, and there's a commercial. And I took a history of animation class, and actually the commercial is a real commercial from the 50s. It's from the Mapo, and you hear the little boy, "I want my Mapo!" Like, that was...
Wow, that's pretty good.
Well, yeah, I do what I can. But that commercial was... It swept everything away. It was super famous, and it was used all the time, that little kid saying, "I want my Mapo!" It was a big deal, so I thought it was really cool. They kind of gave that nod to the 50s by throwing that commercial in there. Yeah, so I just think it's really cool. He really incorporated everything into the movie. So what are the themes of this movie? I think we've kind of talked about a little of them, but let's go into detail what this movie explores.
Well, there's the ending. The ending's awesome.
Yeah, I love the ending that, to me, I mean, when I leave this movie, essentially what I come off saying is essentially that souls don't die. You know, with the giant, you think, oh, he sacrificed himself, that's it. And then we kind of get this little caveat at the end where he's reforming himself and he's still there.
Yeah, I really love that. It was really cool to see that.
Yeah, totally. And so let's not forget about the you are what you choose to be theme. And I really like it. You know, Dean says it first and Hogarth says it again to the giant during the film's climax. And I love it. So it's going against your past or you know, whatever society expects you to be and just choosing your role and essentially your destiny in your own life.
These are very, you know, essential concepts that are very rarely addressed, I feel, in a lot of different movies. The fact of choice, you know, that I can choose that. And there's always this choice, but and also the effects of those choices. And the fact that somebody's death or somebody's life means such a different thing to different people. And it was really cool to see that.
Yeah, I like that, you know, with the you are what you choose to be. You know, the giant chose to be Superman. That was, you know, through the comic books that Hogarth showed him who he aspired to be. And it was just perfect timing for Brad Bird because he was working for Warner Brothers. So they, you know, of course mm-hmm. the studio was going to let them use Superman, which for is sure. one of their flagship brands. I think if Disney were trying to do this or someone else, you might not be able to pull that mm-hmm. off. So it really kind of was this serendipitous moment with everything coming together.
Yeah, that's a great insight.
Well, thank you.
I also picked up on this theme of paranoia and mistrust that happened during the Cold War period. Obviously, I wasn't alive during those times, but you see it in the film. Well, the best example for me is Kent's monologue, you know, when he's talking to Hogarth while they're having a milkshake, or as Hogarth called it, a landslide at the ice cream parlor. Everyone's first reaction to this concept of this mysterious giant is that it's, you know, it's a foreign invader or they're Martians and that we need to retaliate. We need to blow it up, you know. It's interesting because, you know what, I think the world would react like that no matter what era we're in. Like, it's a giant metal robot. It's a giant metal robot. No matter how you slice it. So I just think it's cool. It's kind of like, you know, looking back on ourselves, you know, how would we react to something that we're not familiar with or something that we've never seen before? Do we run away from it? Do we try to pass it off as something hostile? Or do we give it a chance? You know, do we love it?
Yeah.
I don't, you know, if a giant metal robot starts stomping onto my homeland, I don't know how I would feel about that. That's a major theme that I saw this Cold War period, mistrust and paranoia.
Yeah, going along with that, we kind of talked about Sputnik being a symbol for paranoia in the Cold War. Actually, I was reading something that Brad Bird was talking about, and there's one scene, like, you see Sputnik at the beginning, but there's one scene where Hogarth is being held by the giant, they're walking somewhere at night. And you see a star moving next to the moon. And actually, like, during the 50s, Sputnik, you could see from Earth. Like, you could see it, like, moving around. It looked like a star. Kind of added to the paranoia for everyone. You fear what you can't see, but definitely you fear what you can see. And so that was just, like, a visual representation of, I mean, not only in the movie, but to the people who actually live. Here I'm in America, and there's the Russian.
They're watching me.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And so I think it's cool. They kind of just put that in the background. Bird said, I don't think anyone would ever notice it, and we didn't plan on it, but still the extra layer that he put into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And that was Kent Mansley's argument during the film. And now that we're on the subject of Mansley here, I like the comparison between Mansley and Dean. It's kind of this weird kind of father figure thing that they have going on with Hogarth. You know, in the movie, Hogarth doesn't have a dad. And when Mansley comes into his life, you know, he comes into the movie, he sees a strange man, you know, occupying his house, you know, obviously threatened.
Room for rent.
Yeah, he's threatened by it. You know, Mansley, he tries to connect, he's patronizing, but he sucks at connecting with Hogarth, you know.
I wonder why.
Because his intentions aren't pure. He's more interested in what he wants to accomplish and how he wants to look. Then he doesn't really care about Hogarth. He just is using him.
Well, he doesn't care about anyone. I mean, at the very end, he says, you got to die for your country. And Kent's
screw
like,
screw my country. I want to live.
You know,
I was like, oh,
completely self-centered. It's not anything about him.
Well, that's just plain un-American. Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's a scumbag. But, you know, Dean, on the other hand, though he is a beatnik, he's not intrusive. he's standoffish at first, but then he kind of accepts Hogarth, and then he accepts what Hogarth is trying to accomplish with the giant, that he can live in peace with him and that he can trust the giant. And so he believes that, and he connects more with Hogarth.
The definition of a beatnik.
There you go.
Everyone's best friend. Why? And, because he's so cool.
Or hip.
Hip.
Yeah, definitely. And Mansley's not hip at all. And and to me, this whole theme of, you know, these two men kind of not competing, but they kind of do have competing. They kind of do seem to be competing as the man in Hogarth's life. And it seems like a relative theme. You know, I was thinking back with the number of single parent households that increased by the late 1900s. You know, you can imagine what children in that same situation as Hogarth, you know, must feel when a new parent figure, you know, possible parent figure comes into their life. You know, fortunately, my parents are together and I never really experienced that, but you can still imagine it. Something that, you know, kind of came to be an increase, you know, towards the last couple of years. And I think this movie kind of makes a message about that, or it makes a similarity to that.
Yeah, that's definitely something that I see as a theme in animated movies and all movies, is that this trend of the single parent household, whether the parent is divorced, one parent has died, you see this a lot. And I think it's just because it's a very simple, easy way to show that conflict and struggle and history of the character. You just say, hey, this person's father died, and instantly there's a whole gamut of emotions that I can associate to Hogarth and what he's gone through. You know, you don't really need to elaborate on the backstory of what happened there, because we as people already can kind of feel that.
Ah, human emotions. So predictable.
We never change. All right, so last bit, we like to always close with our favorite quotes from the film. And this one had lots and lots of good ones.
Oh, man, it had such good ones. Okay, when he's watching that science fiction movie that Hogarth is watching late at night, and the guy's like, huh, a perfectly good brain. I think you've seen enough. I love those. It's just perfect. It's funny because it's a movie within a movie, but it's totally making fun of those cheesy sci-fi.
I loved it. I laughed so hard when I saw that.
Well, and they use the stereotypical, like, haunted brain, or like the brain that comes back to life. It's just perfect.
You've got your kind of your bimbo lady, and then your, like, stoic.
You want to go back to my place.
Seriously.
That's what he said.
I know.
That's what he said. Oh my gosh, it's funny, man. Oh. And then, oh, I seem to have forgot my keys. And he, like, goes back. It's like melodrama, but it's, you know, the acting back then was so melodramatic, but still, like, so stoic and, like, stone-faced at the same time. It was, oh, man.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Did people really act like that back then, or was that just how they acted, you know?
I don't know.
That's what I wonder.
I like, and then I like his public service announcement video he's watching at school. But then suddenly, without warning, atomic holocaust.
Duck and cover.
Oh, and then bomb falls right on the desk, and everything is blown up except for the kid, because they ducked and covered.
Right.
To do. And I like that kind of irrational thinking during the panic of the Cold War. You know, for any of our listeners who's ever played the video game series, the Fallout series, you see a lot of that in there, too.
Towards the end of the movie, they challenge that idea, because Kent's like, well, let's go to the bomb shelter. Let's hide.
Yeah.
And then the general's like, you idiot. There will be no surviving. Like, you know, kind of just showed that, like, you know, the government back then, they created this propaganda that, I don't know, it just kind of was to appease the mind of the public.
Yeah,
definitely. You idiot.
All right.
I know, I love it. He's like, that bomb is set to detonate on the giant's position. Where's the giant, Mansley? It's like funny, but it's like, holy crap, this is a nuclear bomb.
Yeah, holy crap.
All right. Okay, how about this quote? My own giant robot. I am now the luckiest kid in America. This is like cooler than like television or something. No, they'll panic. People always wig out and they start shooting when they see something big like you.
Because you know, that's every kid in America would say that.
Yes.
Or boy.
Wig out.
Well, yeah, if you notice that they use the term wig out about like 4 or 5 times during this movie. Like, once I started paying attention, I mean, was that a popular term in the 50s?
I don't know. It's over there.
Well, it's a good term. I think
I'm going to take it back into existence in my day and age. So. I mean, people might wig out, but I don't care.
That's our tribute to the Iron Giant. We're bringing wig out back.
I'm going back to my beatnik ways, and I don't care. Take that, man.
Way to stick it.
You're such a tough beatnik, Chelsea.
I know.
So revolutionary.
Oh, well.
Okay, here's one. Hug, hug. I don't know why that quote's so funny.
I don't know. It
is. Like when Chelsea and I, we were watching this together, and Chelsea's never seen it before, but you busted up laughing when you saw that.
Hug, hug.
Hug, hug. Hug, hug. Hug, hug. Hug,
okay. Oh, I like the part. Okay. You know the part where the giant has just appeared and there's all these bites missing out of things and things are being eaten and destroyed. And Dean, he owns a scrap shop, and so there's these two guys selling his tractor, and the one guy's like, Dean's like, yeah, sorry, I can't pay you more, but it's got this large bite out of it. And the old man's like, that's why I'm selling it. It's got a large bite out of it. Okay, this is one, whenever I hear the word blah, 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 like my mom said that today, she was telling me a story, she's like, yeah, yeah, you know, blah, 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 like that. There's something when Hogarth is trying to teach the giant to talk, he's like, can you talk? You know, words, blah, 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 like that. Can you do that? Blah, blah, blah. And then the giant goes, blah, blah, blah. Well, you get the idea.
One of Vin Diesel's greatest lines.
Greatest lines.
Go, Vin Diesel. Oh, man. And I love how he knows exactly what his mother would do. And so he says, and if she comes looking for me and sees you, well, then we got the whole screaming problem again. It never work out. But my favorite, you know, going, Dean is my beatnik friend. He was like, you'd be surprised at how many people want to steal scrap. Once I turn it into art, I can't give it away. What am I, a junk man who sells art or an artist who sells junk?
The paradox of being an artist.
How do you feel about that, Mason?
Huh? You know, I don't, my medium isn't junk, so. I just can't relate to this beatnik.
But another Dean quote that I really loved, or the second time he meets Hogarth, and he's like, oh, hey, I know you, Squirrel Boy. Hogarth, by night, known as Hogarth. I was like, sweet. Coming back with the superhero notions. But my favorite one was, I don't know why I laughed so hard at this one, but right when that hand is like walking through the house and he like tries to take it back to the robot to put himself together, Hogarth's like, if you're gonna stay here, you have to start keeping track of yourself. That's so funny.
Okay, guys, so that's our episode for today.
Yay!
Yeah. A fabulous movie. We went over The Iron Giant, and I'm a huge fan of this movie. I'm really glad that we got to do it as our second. It's up there, top 10 animated features of all time in my book.
For sure.
Yeah, absolutely. The Iron Giant, while it does give... I give it 4 stars because it's not... For me, it's not the perfect animated film, but it is a masterpiece as far as animation goes. So yeah, really great film.
And being my first time seeing it, I would actually give it 4 stars as well. It wasn't my absolute favorite, but I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I got a lot out of it, too.
I'm kind of on the fence right now. I'm between 4 and 4.5. I can't...
4.25?
No, that's not fair.
4.25.
4.25.
It's possible in Zelda.
Well, this is true. I don't know. Let's see. What would I say this movie? I will give this 4.5 stars, just because I have kind of a bias towards Brad Bird. So anything he does actually gets a little bump up in my book. So just for that reason alone, not alone, but among all the other things we talked about today, 4.5 stars. So
in fact, just because it has Brad Bird's name, it gets like that extra 25 points in there. It's like taking your SATs.
Yeah.
You just get 25 points for writing your name or something.
Yes.
That's Brad Bird.
So,
all right.
Okay, perfect. So, for all of our listeners out there, if you haven't seen The Iron Giant, please go out and rent it. You know, everyone nowadays has Netflix, it seems. So, if you don't have Netflix, go to your neighbor. It's on the Netflix instant queue. So, essentially, you can just watch it anytime you want. This is always a movie that my brother and I go to whenever we're on the couch because it really is that good and has that much replay value. So, go watch The Iron Giant and let us know what you think about it.
Yeah, totally. Go grab the DVD if you can and listen to the commentary. But yeah, if not, just go on Netflix and watch it. It's right there.
Yeah.
We just want to thank everyone for listening in, and also for those who listen to our pilot episodes. We're going to have a lot more episodes coming up and a lot more exciting movies, so keep watching, and we appreciate your support.
Yeah, last week I was looking at the numbers of the number of people who'd listened to our show, and we have over 100 people who have listened.
Yay!
All right!
I am completely shocked. I was expecting maybe like friends and family, that's it, you know, 20.
It wasn't that big of a shock for me that we had 100 listeners.
Really?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, he apparently has more faith.
Yeah, and I'm really excited. So we have people listening in Germany, Russia, Italy, Spain, England, hey. Canada, Australia, like hey. All over the place, not to mention a ton of states around the country. So it's just really exciting. You know, people are looking for animation. They're wanting to discover and learn more, and they're stumbling upon it. So it's really exciting for me. Yeah, so if you have any thoughts or comments about The Iron Giant, or, you know, just send us an email and we'll read it on the air and give us your thoughts about, you know, what was your favorite character, your favorite scene, or what you thought or disagreed with us. Our email is therotoscopers@gmail.com, or you can send us a tweet at therotoscopers on Twitter. So we're also on Tumblr on The Rotoscopers, and we have a Facebook fan page, which is facebook.com/therotoscopers. All right. Well, until then, we're The Rotoscopers.
See you next time.
And that's the rest of the story.
Essentially, it's a boy in the Cold War who meets a giant metal giant. Oh.
Yes.
A giant metal giant. Sorry. I don't believe that.
Okay. I'll say it again.
Until next week, we are the Rotoscope.
Roto.
Yes.
It's no R.
Rotor.
Rotoscoper.
I should have done my voice practicing before this. La 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 la. Oh, too late to be known as John the First. John the
West.
The awful. Got it all wrong, Hiss. It's the sniveling scoundrel, no good. But sire, it's a big hit. The whole village is singing it.
Well, they'll be singing. Up with the taxes.
And then triple
squeeze
the taxes.
Every last drop.
All right.